Is presented by the Writers and Illustrators of the Future. They've been providing a means for new and budding writers to have a chance for the creative efforts to be seen and acknowledged. Welcome to Chatting with Sherry. Tonight we chat with a collector of vintage paperbacks and an expert in that field, Jules Burt. We're going to talk about collecting and different kinds of vintage books, such as the Penguin books, the old ones, the green and the red and yellow. We're also going to talk about Pan and a bunch of other things. We're also talk about Agatha Christie, something we have in common, and all kinds of stuff. It's a really fun chat. Here's Jules. Hi, Jules. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Sherry. Thank you very much for inviting me on.
Thank you. I'm really excited. I'm very fascinated by your collection and what you do. I can't wait to chat with you about it.
No problem. Yeah, well, you far away. I'm all yours.
That sounds wonderful. Well, first of all, were you collecting when you were a little boy?
Yeah, definitely. Perhaps not my dad, but my mum and her father, so my grandfather, had what I would call the collecting gene. So my grandfather collected old china and stamps, and my mum, she collected records and she collected paperbacks as well. And I think I inherited that gene. My sister's got it a little bit, but I definitely had the bug when I was still at school, you know, like a 12, 13-year-old. I'd already started collecting stuff even back then. Doctor Who books, paperbacks, for example. I inherited, my mum gave me her Agatha Christie Pan paperbacks. I had my dad's James Bond paperbacks, Ian Fleming's. And that started me down that particular collecting avenue. I also collected toys as well. And the stuff I had as a kid, I never really got rid of when a lot of people did. So when Star Wars came around, I still had all my Star Wars toys. And in the 90s, I got back into it. I tried to find the bits and pieces of Star Wars I never had as a kid. Old video games as well. But underlying through all of that, I always had an interest in collecting books and worked in books as well for quite a long time. Was a book buyer for a national book chain in the UK. And I have always collected books, literally for 4 decades now. So that all of that and the history of being a retailer, a collector, then a retailer of this sort of stuff led to me 5 years ago starting to share it on YouTube, which is, I think, how you found me.
Yeah.
We're through there. So that's the journey, really.
I think it's really interesting because I've always loved books, but I've always loved movies and TV shows, too. I'm sort of like an equal opportunity lover of art. Of different kinds of art. But one of the things that had me collecting books was my mom and dad, we would be watching an old movie like Auntie Mame, and one of them said, you know, that was a book. And all of a sudden I go, my eyes lit up, and really? And I would spend my allowance going to, because back then they had them at swap meets and garage sales, and looking, swap meets were great. Swap meets, I found like Auntie Mame and other old movie tie-in books. They were amazing. Now swap meets don't have books at all, at least not here.
Well, secondhand books in general are getting harder to find. The secondhand bookshops are struggling to stay open. And a lot of stuff has moved online, although certainly in the UK we're seeing a massive resurgence in people starting to collect vintage paperbacks. I think it's because new people are discovering the hobby through through places like YouTube, and there are a couple of specialist magazines as well, and the Facebook groups. That's probably the key places where people are meeting like-minded collectors, trading, swapping, and buying books between them. And I think the collectible paperback market is definitely on the rise. I think it's a whole new generation of people getting into it, which and in certain genres more than others, like science fiction, people are buying vintage science fiction because there's a real lack of modern stuff, which they're just not finding interesting. And crime, I mean, crime's got, you know, 100-year very, very rich history, and there's no way you've read them all. So,
no. Impossible.
Exactly right. So, you know, there's different areas that you can, there's always something new that you can explore. You know, I've been, you know, dipping my toe into some of the 1930s crime, but also, I vaguely sort of heard of them, but I've never read any. And that's the fun of collecting, and certainly there's an endless stream of it. You can just, you know, keep going forever and ever, can't you? But that's the fun of being a book collector. And I think it is very accessible. One of the main reasons I started collecting paperbacks was because I always wanted to have, say, a set of the James Bond first editions. But even 30 years ago, when I started putting a paperback set together, those books were, you know, like the first one was four figures at the time, over £1,000. You know, it's £50,000 for a copy of Casino Royale now. But the paperback first, back then, I picked up for £15.
Wow.
I add another zero on that nowadays, but even so, £150 for a paperback first or £50,000 for a hardback first, you know, there was no real comparison. So I always refer to paperbacks as the poor man's first edition. But at the same time, you're still getting the same book, you're still getting something collectible, a future collectible, for a fraction of the money. And you can get a lot more for your money. Imagine how many paperbacks you could get for the cost of one Casino Royale.
Yeah.
And there's quite a lot of that in it for me as well. I do like value for money. I love buying job lot collections when they come my way. You know, I buy, you know, a couple of thousand books or something. It doesn't happen very often, but it has happened. And, you know, going through them book by book, I just love that. I think that's the other reason for books, so paperbacks especially, is value for money.
I mean, you said it was £50,000 for Casino Royale. You could buy a car for £50,000.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, yeah. Maybe two cars.
You'd have to really look even to go out and find one. I mean, I think the print run on that was only about 1,000 copies anyway, and half of those went to libraries. So they're, you know, they're always beaten up. But they are out there, but you'd have to wait for a nice one to come up on the market.
Yeah.
You know, to find one, but they are out there. But it's a very particular collector who perhaps would even want something like that. I would love an original set, but I don't think it's going to happen somehow.
Yeah, not that price. No. Very prohibitive.
Yeah, in actual fact, that the American paperback first is actually much rarer to get than the British one. And it's not actually called Casino Royale. They renamed it in America, and they called it Too Hot to Handle.
You know, it is crazy that they rename all... They're still doing it. They rename books when they come here. It's happening.
At the time, it was, you know, a different market, perhaps, you know, so it is what it is, you know. It's, that meant that the American one, which was published by Perma Books, is about $600, which is, you know, a few times more than the British first, which is a bit more common.
Yeah. But, oh my gosh, I wish we still had swap meets that had books, because I would be hunting for that book, man.
Well, we've just had the, I'd say just in March, a couple of months ago, there was the London Paperback Show. And that's held in London, and there was about 12 dealers, but each of them had two or three stalls, so there were 12 decent-sized paperback specialist dealers, and an ephemera fair next door to it as well. So the whole thing was quite the sight to behold, and it was rammed, absolutely rammed, that show. And, there's definitely a market for it. I, you know, I think there's not enough of those sorts of shows around the UK. And I do feel there's enough of an audience to warrant them, you know. And there's a couple in the States. There's the Windy City paperback and pulp show. And I think there's one in New York as well. There's definitely an LA show. So there's a few in America, but, you know, they're only once a year. So you'd have to sort of pick your moment and travel to them. But they're much bigger than the British show. You know, and they have, you know, 100 plus dealers and usually some authors as well, if they're still alive. You know, they usually get a few authors to go along to do signing. You know, I'd love to go to one of the big American shows at some point. I really would.
I've been to the big book fair at UCLA, which is humongous, and they always have it in the summer, so it's always really hot. but it's great. And then there's another book fair in the San Fernando Valley that I've been to a few times. I grew up in LA, but now I live in San Diego, so it's a little bit harder to get to those things now. But I would recommend probably the San Fernando one because it's not as huge. If you want signed books, I mean, they do have really big authors at the UCLA one, you know. So it's up to you when you come.
Oh, yeah. I was in L.A. in 2019, the summer of 2019, and that was like a family holiday. We're certainly intending to go back, but I think we're doing Chicago. So if I can time it so the Windy City Comic Con is on at the same time, or paperback show is on at the same time, that would be really good timing. So you never know, I might be able to make that one out of all of them.
I lived there for a while. I love Chicago. It's a great place.
Never been to Chicago, so I'd like to go. That's for sure.
It's really, I loved it. They have great museums too. I mean, the Field Museum is to die for. if you like Egyptology, they have a great have an Egypt exhibit there. It's so cool.
Yeah.
It's like you're going into a tomb.
Right. Yeah, I do like Egyptology. Yeah, I do. I got interested in that.
Yeah, definitely go to the Field Museum when you go there. Worth the day.
Not be for a couple. It's on the list. Yeah, it's on the list.
It's funny because I go to the local. There's several local used bookstores that I go to. One right here where I live, but there's also like in La Jolla and different places. And we do have a lot of really good used bookstores, but I do buy a lot of my stuff online.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's the easiest way in a lot of cases to find stuff, isn't it? Is just go online and do some hunting. You can generally find those things.
Oh, the one in Liverpool that you went to, I bought some books through her. She's such a nice lady.
Yeah, Reed of Liverpool, was it Reed? I can't remember now.
I think
That was an interesting shop, that one.
Yeah, I got some Penguin Green crime novels from her.
Oh, was it the one, was it from the Ironbridge bookshop? Does that ring a bell, the Ironbridge bookshop?
I think that's it. I think it's the Ironbridge.
Yeah. They've got some, they are, you could say, Penguin specialists. They've got probably the best selection in a shop that I know of in the UK, in all honesty. Meg, she's called, lovely Meg.
She's very nice.
It is. Yeah, I've been there twice now. And, I always find, I was a little bit pushed for time this time because we were on the way home, so I only had like an hour in there. So I made the most of it and filmed and did a quick shot. But I feel if I had like a day there, I could really go through it properly and check against all my list stuff because although she hasn't got any early ones that I want, there's lots from like the, because Penguin are numbered, the first 1,000 I've almost got licked bar one. But then the second and third 1,000s, I've got about half of them. So there's loads of those that I need, and I've just sort of started to seriously start to fill in those spaces now in the collection. But I'm being quite strict with the conditions. So those later ones, I do only want really nice copies if possible, and of course first editions, first Penguin printings. Don't want any reprints.
Yeah, I have. I got an Agatha Christie and a Niall Marsh.
Two good authors. Yeah, Agatha Christie's particularly hot at the moment. She has been for the last 5 years. She is a hot author, absolutely incredible. But the books don't seem to ever go out of style. You know, I'm not much of a fan of the modern jackets, but the vintage jackets are brilliant.
Crime,
aren't they? But
Tom Adams. Is that the right one? Fontana,
that's exactly right, yeah.
Yeah, I have several of those. I love them.
They are great. I mean, they're not expensive to collect. I would have loved to have met him. He actually lives in the same county as me, he lived in the same county as me in Devon. But he passed away pretty much as I was starting the channel up.
Oh.
2020, so I never got the chance to track him down and interview him, because I definitely would have wanted to, because I'm a big fan of his work, which is a shame. I actually know one of my acquaintances, a big Christie collector, has got three original Adams covers. He owns three.
Cool.
It didn't cost him a lot at the time, but now, I mean, you know, not priceless, but you know, very sought after, I would think. Indeed.
I'm so glad that when David Suchet did his Being Perot, I think was the name of his documentary, he interviewed Tom Adams. And
I must track that down. Yeah.
I think it was the Being Perot one. I think that was the one. It was all about he interviewed him, and he interviewed why can't I think of the grandson, not the great-grandson, because that's the one who runs the company now. The grandson, Agatha Christie's grandson. And he interviewed him, and they gave him, Tom Adams gave him a tour of his studio and showed all the different things, and they both wished that she was around to see his work. And then Tom Adams goes, well, maybe not. I don't think she'd like my covers.
Well, hard to tell. I think she'd be, I think she would have looked at it. She was quite shrewd, you know, Agatha Christie. So there is a point in history, sort of about 1955, where she had Penguin, Pan, and Collins / Fontana all publishing her books at the same time.
That is amazing.
But she had like a third of the works, and they were all trying to outdo each other. Now Penguin, obviously with their generic green covers, they didn't do any artwork ones like Pan did, or Fontana / Collins. So what Penguin did, they got Christie to write some new introductions. They got her to select some of her favourite stories, which were being published by Penguin, and she wrote brand new introductions to them. And then Penguin, they did it twice, and Penguin published 100,000 of each of the 10 books. So she was an instant million seller overnight.
Wow.
Yeah, they would do that as like a little bit of a marketing gimmick. Then people would go into the bookshops and pick up all 10. And that's what people do that, you know. But they didn't give anything away free. They did it like with D.H. Lawrence around the time that Lady Chatterley came out. And if you bought all 10, Penguin would produce like a little booklet, like D.H. Lawrence and Appreciation, which the bookshop would give you for free because you bought the whole lot. They didn't do such a thing with Christie, but you know, that's an example of Penguin being Penguin, and a good little bit of marketing there. But yes, but Christie herself was very, either her or her literary manager, was very savvy in getting those different publishers, each of them trying to outdo themselves.
Mm-hmm.
About they pushed Christie. So a lot of the books, even in Pan, have got three, sometimes four jackets, because they kept improving on them and making them fresh, because they were competing with the other publishers, you know. Very interesting. They did all the mixing come together, didn't they, into the Tom Adams ones, but back then they were quite splintered amongst other publishers.
There was a very modern portrait of Agatha Christie, and it wasn't really flattering, but it was striking. She was older in the, but she liked it. She had it on, she framed it, and she had it on her wall. So I think that I think Tom was wrong. I think she would have liked his work.
Yeah, I agree. And they sold absolute bucket loads, those Fontana editions. They were so good. I mean, in fact, Tom Adams himself did some of the titles. He did more than one version, because he started doing them in the late 60s and carried on right up into the mid 80s. And then he did some different covers again for American editions. You know, he slowed down in later years, but at the same time, you know, he made an entire career out of it. You know, he didn't do a lot else except covers, you know.
What was the other, you said Fontana / something, what was the other company that...
Collins. So Collins did their Classic Crime Club, and they also published Agatha Christie in hardback. And around about 1953, Collins Crime Club stopped in paperback, and they launched Fontana paperbacks. So that was... it was the same company, but they relaunched it as Fontana, because around that time you had Pan had got established, Penguin were already well established, and Fontana came on. They were another big player, and there was a lot of other ones. Corgi Books came along, Panther Books. There was a massive explosion of publishers in the UK in the early to mid 1950s, because paper rationing finally in the UK came to an end, because up to that point all the early Pans, for example, are all published in France and then shipped down the Seine into the Thames, into the UK, because there was no paper to be had in the UK. So it was only sort of the early to mid-50s that the publishers suddenly had enough paper to start producing books in proper quantities, which they did. And that gave rise to all these different publishers. And Collins just decided to rebrand themselves, because they'd had the same look since, you know, 1936. So they were looking a little bit dated, a bit like Penguin. Around 55-ish, 53 to 55, they started adding a few little illustrations on the front. So Dare the Triffids, which is 1954 in Penguin, has a little illustration of a Triffid on the front. Now, they didn't do it with all of them, but they did start to dabble in it, because, you know, they were starting to look a bit old-fashioned compared to the other books at the time. So, yeah, it's an interesting thing to study. If you look at, if you were just to pull books all from one year out that were published in a certain year, the difference between the different publishing houses, they were all trying to differentiate themselves. You know, and Pan had a very distinctive look. The Fontanas do, the early ones, are like light blue. Then they go to like a yellow design. And then obviously later on in the late 60s, they then start to have the fully painted covers by Tom Adams, that we know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like a little progression, but yeah, they're all trying to sort of stand out on the shelf amongst a lot of other publishers.
Now, when you were talking about a Fontana book with Tom Adams, you said there's a signature. I know it's a Fontana, I know it's Tom Adams, but where are the signatures?
They're not often. I mean, just know if it's his style or not. I mean, you can clearly see it, but no, often they don't have signatures at all. He wasn't one of those authors, artists who did put signatures on, actually. Some do, some don't, but he generally didn't. A lot of artists did, but no, but you know it's one of his. And the thing is, all the actual Tom Adams covers have all been very clearly catalogued, so you know it doesn't take a lot to look up his entire book output, you know, so you can clearly see which books he actually did the covers for. But as I said, some of the Christies, he ended up doing two or more for, sometimes three.
Wow.
I think like Destination, sorry, Towards Zero, for example, has like a really psychedelic 60s one from like 1967-68. A new jacket comes along not long after, about 72-73. And then he did a different one again for the American paperback release by Pocket. So, you know, if you're being a completist, you'll want them all, of course.
Mm-hmm. So that's another question I have. So is Pocket related to Fontana? Because I have some pocket ones that look like Tom Adams, but I didn't know if it could be, because I wasn't sure if it was related to the same company.
Right, not related to the same company. Pocketbooks were definitely, at that time, were definitely a separate entity that got gobbled up into Simon & Schuster as the bigger company. But it could, a bit like in the UK, Christie in America was published by different publishers. So there's some in Dell, there's some in Avon Books, and there's some in Pocketbooks. And I've got examples of them all. But eventually, a bit like in the UK, where they all became published by Fontana, which then became Collins, in the States, they ended up, the majority of them anyway, being published by one publisher, which is Pocket. So they could then have a uniform look across the entire series, rather than being different ones. And they would have just been the company in America who actually had the rights for it. But they're not related to Collins in the UK at all.
Okay. Because there's some of those pockets that look like a Tom Adams cover, but I thought Tom Adams didn't have anything to do with it. So I was like, I wonder, did they rip them off? Rip them off or something?
Yeah, they are Tom Adams, and they're definitely his artwork, but it's different artwork. He also did, I think he did a run of Raymond Chandler or Dashiell Hammett. There's about 12. Once again, all with covers by Tom Adams, which are absolutely beautiful. I've seen pictures of them. I haven't got any of them. But as I said, there are a couple of websites devoted to Tom Adams, and you can get a checklist quite easily. And certainly in the UK, those Fontana ones are very, very easy to get. In fact, I mentioned earlier on, before we started recording, how I went to a dealer literally today. All you need is books. You've got 100,000 vintage books, and he last year he bought a collection of about 1,000 Agatha Christie books.
Wow.
And I bought quite a few from him at the time, but I went through today and I filmed a beautiful, it was about 5 stacks of all the Tom Adams ones, and really high grade quality copies. So that'll be in the video that's coming out this Sunday, A Trip to All You Need Is Books. And there's a 2-minute segment where I go through all the books we've just been talking about.
Cool.
They are fantastic to see. I love them.
I have an Avon book that's Around the World in 80 Days by Jules Verne. It's such a beautiful cover.
Yeah, well, they won't be. And Avon are one of those publishers that had a reputation for doing that really nice, slightly garish, but bold and bright jackets. I've got a handful of, most of the American publishers, the vintage ones, I've got a few of in my collection.
Well, this one is,
I tend to like that.
It is a yellow jacket. Is that what you meant by garish? Because it is a yellow jacket.
Very bright, sort of highly saturated colors. Once again, designed to jump off the shelf in a very busy market, you know. So that's why they are like they are, you know. They try and make them as sensationalist as possible. That's what they were like back then.
Did you, I know you love science fiction and stuff. Did you know that the balloon was not in the book, but the first movie that Mike Todd did back in the 60s with David Niven had a balloon in it? And because that was such a sensational movie and it was a big hit, all of a sudden, all book covers have a balloon. And all of the adaptions have a balloon.
Yeah, I did not know that. Oh, that's interesting. An interesting bit of trivia, then.
Because yeah, no, I just was reading it. I'm rereading my book, and I was like, oh, that's right, there's no balloon, because he made it all the way, he's in already gone through India on his way to Asia, and I'm like, oh, there's no balloon in the book. It's right, there's no balloon. But it's on the cover of the book that there's a balloon. There's a on this book, Avon has a balloon on it.
Right. Oh, wow. Well, there you go. Yeah, I can believe it. I can believe it. I didn't actually know that a little bit of trivia, so, yeah.
Yeah,
that's good.
That was all Mike Todd. he did that. Well, he also put all the movie stars in it, you know. It was practically every movie star in Hollywood had a little tiny part in Around the World in 80 Days.
I like those, what do they call them? There's a word for it when they have a massive cast like that. But there's a few, isn't there, like that? And I like those sorts of movies. They don't tend to do them so often these days, do they? But,
no, not really. I mean, and these were all little tiny cameos. Like, they were... Yeah. Frank Sinatra and all these people, tiny, teeny, tiny little cameos. It's really fun, though, to spot the movie stars are watching.
Yeah. Again, another one I'm going to have to have a look out for, I think.
Yeah. Shirley MacLaine plays the princess. She always thought she was terrible because she goes, blonde-haired, a blue-eyed, freckle-faced girl playing an Indian princess. I think she was blonde, or was she redheaded in that? I don't remember, but she says just didn't fit the character.
Yeah, another one I shall keep an eye out for.
But I just thought it was funny because it affected the book so much.
Definitely, I haven't got an Avon one, that's for certain, but I've got a Penguin Modern Classic, one of the hardbound, cloth-bound classics.
Mm-hmm.
I've got that for Around the World in 80 Days. And I must have another couple of editions. I've got other Jules Verne, that's for certain.
Yeah, the two I like best is Around the World in 80 Days and Journey to the Center of the Earth.
I've only got the one edition, that I can think of Around the World in 80 Days, which is a bit more modern. It was one that came out in the last 10 years. It's actually the Penguin Cloth Bound Classic Edition. I haven't got a vintage paperback of it. I might have, actually, now I come to think about it. I've got some Jules Verne, but it's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and I think it's a tie-in edition to the Disney version of that film. So, but I can't remember who the publisher is. It might be a Dell or it might be an Avon. I can't remember. But I like him as an author, though.
I do too.
I read him when I... Yeah, and in fact, that was one of the reasons why I changed... Well, I didn't officially change my name, but I prefer to be called Jules after Jules Verne.
Aww.
In actual fact, my name is Julian, so there you go. Yeah.
I love 20,000 Leagues. 20,000 Leagues, the movie, the Disney movie, didn't that a Kirk Douglas?
Yes, it does. Yeah,
yeah, I remember that movie.
Yeah, that's right. And it's a good one. I watched it for the first time in years, about 2 or 3 years ago, and I thought it still held up really well.
And Captain Nemo was Walter Pigeon, right?
Oh, I can't remember. It may well be, but definitely Kirk Douglas is in it. He's the memorable one.
Yeah, well, yeah, because Kirk Douglas is
remember
Kirk Douglas. But yeah, that's a good movie. I still remember all the Disney movies I grew up watching. I love those movies.
Yeah, me too. I think the first one I fell in love with was probably The Jungle Book. And that wasn't first time around. That was sort of when it came around again in the mid-70s. And I remember that one probably, you know, specifically being a really good Disney film. But back then, they were starting to be shown on TV, and some of the classic 101 Dalmatians and things like that, the Aristocats, the Robin Hood one. They were great, you know. And Disney still is a force to be reckoned with, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, they've taken it to a whole new level, Disney.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And a lot of like Pixar, another company that I really like. They own Pixar now, don't they?
Oh yeah.
But yeah, what a rich heritage. And I think more than any other company, they do very well mining their heritage as well, because it is so long and varied, you know. A few companies could take a page out of their book.
You're an expert on books, and all I keep hearing on BookTube are tie-ins are terrible, but I love my tie-in books.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. As I said, the first thing I ever collected was tie-in books. It was my Doctor Who paperbacks. So it's the ones published by Target back in the 70s, 1973 they started, when the show was still on TV, and they were the first books I started collecting, and they were tie-ins, but I always used to like movie tie-ins as well. And if you think back to the day when in the UK we had 3 TV channels,
mm-hmm, here too.
you would occasionally get a big film on a repeat or on a Sunday afternoon, but it was a way to relive the movie. So when Star Wars came out, I read the book and I read the comic strip adaptation many, many times, because it was a way to keep the film in your mind, as it were, because the only way you could see it was going to the cinema. It wasn't like you could just whack in a DVD or stream it or something like that.
Exactly.
And I think that tie-ins were so important a part of a show's sort of history, really. And the more popular the show, generally, the more tie-in things that came along for it, even movies as well, would sometimes have unofficial sequels put out in book form. Dirty Harry, for example, had an adaptation for the 5 Dirty Harry movies, mm-hmm, but there was a separate set that came out in the mid-80s, long after about the time of the last movie, which was a series, I think it was 8 or 12 books, just based on the Dirty Harry character. So I think there's a lot to be said for tie-in novels, and yes, they can be a bit formulaic, but some of them are actually, they take the characters to a level that they couldn't possibly do on TV, and the Star Trek paperbacks would be an example of that, mm-hmm, where they explore themes which they would never maybe nowadays they might risk it, but back when Star Trek was just Captain Kirk and Mr. Spock, there were themes visited there that wouldn't be in books, that they would never have dared to do on TV at the time. And there's some great stuff in there, real great literary stuff, and anyone who disses tie novelizations or adaptations obviously hasn't studied the genre properly enough, because there's some really, really good stuff out there.
I love them. I do. I have a copy of the movie Somewhere in Time with Christopher, a book of the book form, with Christopher Reeve and Jane Seymour. It's signed by Richard Matheson. You cannot beat that.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good one to have. I think, as I said, I've got a bit of a mixture of TV and film ties, but my oldest film tie is one from the First World War by John Buckham, who did the
39 Steps.
And the 39 Steps in there. And he did a British government war propaganda film during the First World War. Okay, so yeah, my second, my oldest movie tie would be one from, I think it's 1922, and it's for the silent movie by Harold Lloyd, and he did a film, Speedy.
Oh, wow! That is cool!
Yeah, I've got it's a hardback, but it's like paperback size, so it's not as big as a normal regular hardback today, but slightly bigger than a normal paperback would be today. And it's got a dust jacket on it as well, with a picture of the film on the front and some stills in the middle, so it is like a proper movie tie-in.
I didn't know they did that back then.
So that's the 1920s. I don't mind Harold Lloyd, but I would have preferred something on Laurel and Hardy. That would have been even better,
Or Charlie Chaplin.
See, I'm less keen. Out of the three, it's Laurel and Hardy, Harold Lloyd, then Charlie Chaplin.
Okay.
I'm not so much been a fan, I don't know why. It's just maybe I've seen less, but Laurel and Hardy are always my top favourites.
Oh, I love them.
Me too. Absolutely.
Well, Harold Lloyd's American, and the other three are all British, so.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Actually, yeah, that's a good way of. I hadn't thought of that. Actually, Laurel and Hardy did their very last public appearance together as Laurel and Hardy on stage in my hometown in Plymouth. Their very last show in the world.
Wow.
Was when they were touring the UK. Yeah. I don't know how well it went down, but I've seen some posters from the event, that have been saved. I think it was about 1955, something like that. They were both quite old by then, but they were brilliant. Yeah, I would have loved to have seen them.
I would have loved to have seen them, too. Stan Laurel lived in Los Angeles. I think Oliver Hardy stayed in Britain, right?
Yeah, in fact, he had family pretty, I wouldn't say just up the road, but about 30 miles from where I live. He had relatives there, so he would visit quite often. And there is sort of footage of him with his family, and there's footage of him, of the two of them when they're in Britain, going around. And they were massive movie stars, as you can imagine,
mm-hmm.
but they struggled to find work. And the stage plays that they were putting on, it was more like sketches, were, you know, it wasn't their best stuff. It's as simple as that, really. So, you know, they would still fill the audiences up. It was a living, but it wasn't what they were accustomed to, really, which is a shame. But it's just that back then when they started, they didn't really make, there weren't the things in place for them to get massive royalties like there are today. And they just got like a flat fee for doing the movies, and you know, they both lived quite long lives, really, you know, so the money ran out, basically.
Yeah.
So they were forced to go back on the stage, which is a shame, really. Yeah, there you go. But yeah, their last ever performance as Lauren Hardy was in my hometown of Plymouth.
Wow.
In the mid-50s, yeah.
Yeah. I, you know who Dick Van Dyke is, right?
Yeah, yeah.
He
yeah.
actually inherited some of Stan Laurel's stuff.
All right.
Because they were good friends.
Right, oh, brilliant. Yeah, oh, that's interesting to know. I know they were friendly with Norman Wisdom as well.
Mm-hmm.
And he lived in Jersey. I'm not sure if he got any bits and pieces, but oh, fantastic. Yeah, I'm a big Laurel and Hardy fan.
Yeah, I love Laurel and Hardy. I think they're great. Now, I have a really, I don't know if, I was wondering about the reprints, you know, of the classic books that are, the you know, with the new editions. What do you think of them? Do you like them, or do you think they're not that good, or how do you feel about the reprints?
Well, it depends from a collector's point of view. Collectors generally want the first printings, but if it's something a bit special, if it's like a new series or something like that, I mean, as I said, I mentioned with the Jules Verne earlier, I have some books that have been put into Penguin cloth-bound classics with a particular designer doing all the jackets. So those, I really like. But generally speaking, as time goes on, if you go in a bookshop today, most of the new books, they're just covered in text. There's no art. There's no thought gone into it, in most cases. So when something nice comes along, you know, it's the exception rather than the rule. The rule is very bland and plain, and it's just cheaply produced in Photoshop.
Well,
and
I was,
it's not something that I'm a fan of.
I was actually thinking, like, HarperCollins has the HarperCollins Muse Painted Editions, and they have a really beautiful Mysteriosphere styles. I just wondered what you thought of that.
They're being marketed at a particular sort of audience, and that's a different sort of thing. So those sort of things I love. There is, you know, there have been, you know, like reprint publishers who very much have got the collector in mind, and even though they're reprinting classic stuff, and you know, they're doing it with a bit of thought, so the actual product itself looks good. And I think that's what they need to be doing. And there's a lot more of that sort of publishing needs to be done, because there's definitely a market for it. And I keep banging the drum, but nothing seems to be happening. Which is why vintage crime and vintage SF in particular are having a massive resurgence, because there's such a dearth of modern stuff. People are just not enjoying it. And I know people who work in the book trade, contemporary book trade, and they're telling me that the stuff just isn't selling. The people buying sort of science fiction / fantasy are predominantly they started with it, like the fantasy, teenage fantasy sort of romance-y style books, and they've grown up now, of course. They're into a particular sort of fantasy, which isn't something that any of us are really ever used to, and a lot of people are looking for some decent science fiction and are struggling to find it, and fantasy. So they're turning to the past, and I think the publishers owe it themselves to remarketed. The biggest success, of course, this year is Dune, then last year, so on the back of the movies, Glance, who published Dune, have done a very good job in rebranding it and repackaging it for a new generation. But there's an awful lot more that could be reprinted, some absolute classics that are not around at the moment, and I think that's where publishers need to look. But as a whole, I wholly approve of reprints if they're done tastefully, but when, you know, there's no effort at all put into them, then, you know, they don't deserve the shelf space, and they don't deserve to sell, in my opinion, you know.
I understand what you're saying about fantasy, though. I've tried a couple of the new fantasy. I'm just not interested in the new stuff. I mean, I'm not anti-fantasy, but it's fantasy mostly. I have nothing against romance. I enjoy romance, but I don't like it to be the focus of a book.
No.
You know, I like Agatha Christie was brilliant at it. She would have a romance in it, but it was never the focus of the story.
No, that's right, absolutely. And this is just, you know, it's just trends, isn't it? This is how things have developed. But you know, it's there's still time, but it takes a publisher with a bit of needs to take a bit of a leap of faith, and you know, publishing new books, even reprints of old books, is a risky business these days, and the whole market is, you know, they're just chasing trends,
yeah,
more than anything else. And every fantasy book has to be like a trilogy, it seems, you know, and think, just, you know, whatever happened to the good standalone novel, you know what I mean? They just don't exist anymore, it seems, and it's just turning people off, and that's why I think, you know, people have turned to people covering old books online, because they're just so sick of what's in the bookshops brand new, and they want to find out old stuff that they could pick up, often quite cheaply, in the second-hand market, and try something a bit different. And that's, if I can help out in that regard and open people's eyes to stuff that I've read or that I've enjoyed collecting, then I think I'm helping out.
Yeah, absolutely. I think your show is great for that. I think your show is fantastic for that, for people who are looking. See, one thing I don't get is, I was at my favorite used bookstore, and it was around my birthday. I always get a pile of books on my birthday because I get money and I buy books. And there was a couple of very nice young women, and they were buying books too, but they wouldn't buy it until they checked the rating on Goodreads.
Really?
And yeah. I thought, why are you doing that? Part of the fun of buying a book is buying it by the seat of your pants.
Well, that is true. I mean, but then again, did they? You know, sometimes, you know, Goodreads is good. I mean, there's no two ways around it, and it's nice to sometimes to hear someone else's opinion on it before you do take the dive. I mean, generally speaking, I used to be a book buyer, so I'm happy to make my own decisions. But I generally have an inkling if I know if I'm going to like it or not within the first few pages. And generally speaking, particularly if you're buying online, you can generally read the first few pages.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got enough there to sort of give you a taste, haven't you? But, you know, it would have to have really, really bad reviews for me to be put off buying it. If it was something I wanted to read, even if it was on a subject that I was interested in but it was badly written, I'd probably still buy it just for the actual content, you know. So, you know, horses for courses.
Yeah, and that's true. I mean, a lot of stuff I buy because I love the author, or I love the genre, or, you know, the period, 1920s, 1940s, you know, they're very fascinating to me. But I mean, you want to make sure that the writer is a good writer. You open the book and you read the first few pages, and yeah, this is good, this is cool, and then you buy it.
The absolute biggest thrill for me is I'll take one of my old paperbacks, one say from the 1930s or the 1940s. So we're now talking about this 1890, almost years old. And I'll have it in my hand, and it'll feel a bit heavier than a modern book because of the paper that was used at the time. And I just sort of think about the history that particular book potentially has been through over all those countless decades, older than even my parents in some cases. And I'll read a book that I've never read before, like a classic crime from the 1930s, and I'll be reading it and experiencing it exactly as they did when this book first came out, mm-hmm. say 1936. And there's something really, really special about that particular feeling. Now, you can buy an old Penguin, say, from that period, a crime one. If you're not fussed about having a first edition, you can probably get one for about, you know, £10-15 for a nice one, and actually have a real, almost an antique, but a real piece of literary history there in your hands. And it's an experience that it's very difficult to replicate nowadays, and it's very difficult to explain. But there's something about reading a really old vintage book like that which is quite special, and that is one of the key things that I really, really love about being a book collector and, you know, dealing and collecting in old books. It's just that's the magic of it, really. If you could bottle up that little bit of essence there, you'd have something.
That you just described exactly why I love old books. The feel of them, the smell of them, they smell so good. And, you know, and the and reading the way it's printed, the font, the whole schmear. I mean, it's all, so special.
It's like a glimpse into like a little time machine, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You know, and I always have sort of, you know, what I'm reading, I bear in mind all those different things about, particularly when it was published, so that you put yourself into that period. So if you're reading a book that was contemporary when it was put into paperback in the mid-30s, that's perfect. You know, you're back there. You're actually there as if you were reading it in the 1930s yourself. And that is just brilliant. I think it's like being in a time machine.
I love that.
So that's where you can get a lot of it from a book, yeah.
And the other thing, that's the other reason I love reading older books, classic books, is it's because it's happening in real time in the book. You get, like, you're in the time machine because you're surrounded by all the stuff, like the clothes and the cigarettes and the dancing and the cars and all, I mean, everything isn't always described, but it's referred to. It's such a cool thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. It's something a bit special, and yeah, this is why I've always loved it. But of course, science fiction is often completely the other direction.
Of course.
Often in the future.
Yeah.
You know, then it sets your mind going in a different direction because you're not looking to the past. You're thinking, well, it's speculative. You don't know what's going to be. You know, is this going to be true? How accurate is it compared to what we know today? And I think that's, you approach it in a different sort of way, you know?
That's true. I mean, one of the things I found fascinating, because nuclear weapons were known when the time machine was done, but he had basically a nuclear blast in it.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
We're coming to the end. What can you give the name of your channel and your website and all the good information like that, your social media?
If anyone wants to have a look at some of my book videos, by all means, just go to YouTube, and if you go into the search box and type in Jules Burt, so JULESBURT, you'll find my channel there. I do also have a website at julesburt.co.uk, which really just links back to the YouTube. So YouTube is really all you want, but I am also fairly active on Instagram. I've been on there under the user ID Penguin Book a Day. So I started on Instagram a long time ago when it first started, and I generally share a paperback pictures of book covers and predominantly Penguin books on that one. So you can see me on there. I'm also on Twitter at Jules Burr as well. So, but YouTube is where it's all happening, and that's where I'm posting four videos a week. So if you want a bit more, predominantly book content, that would be the place to head to.
Thank you. Thank you, Jules. I really appreciate your time. I've really enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, no worries at all. I've enjoyed it, Sharon. Thanks for inviting me to come on.
Thank you. And thank you for chatting with Sherry. If you'd like to help support my radio playhouse, Sherry's Playhouse, you can go to my Patreon page, www.patreon.com/readthebard. And Read the Bard is spelled R-I-T-H-E-B-A-R-D. There's several levels from $1 to $50. You get different gifts, you get different chances to meet casts or to chat about the plays or to talk about any special guests that might be on Chatting with Sherry. It's a lot of fun. We have a good group, and I hope you join us.
This is where projects come to life. Our showrooms are designed to inspire with the latest products from top brands, curated in an inviting, hands-on environment, and a team of industry experts to support your project. We'll be there to make sure everything goes as planned, from product selection to delivery coordination. At Ferguson Bath Kitchen and Lighting Gallery, your project is our priority.
See the latest designs from your favorite brands, including Signature Hardware, at your local Ferguson showroom.